Good morning and welcome to Occupy the Airwaves. Okay, shortly after Russia entered Ukraine's civil war last February, Americans started, and their think tanks, they started talking about, whoa, what if Russia wins? What if those eastern Ukraine manages to get rid of the Kiev regime forces on their land and become independent and stay with Russia the way they voted to? Well, this, we can't have this. We just cannot have the people of eastern Ukraine making the decision for themselves to go ahead and quit the Kiev regime, which is largely full of Nazis now, and just join with Russia instead. So what we'll do is we'll start an insurgency. They openly said, and they've been saying it ever since, not all the time, but just every once in a while, when it's, what if Russia wins? Well, then we'll just turn to terrorism. What is an insurgency? Well, insurgents are U.S.-backed terrorists, just like freedom fighters are U.S.-backed terrorists, and Contras are U.S.-backed terrorists, and moderate rebels are U.S.-backed terrorists. The thing about all of those terms are they're terrorists, but the U.S. backs them, so the media puts them out as freedom fighters or moderate rebels or insurgents or patriots. You know, they'll use all kinds of things. And any atrocity they commit, well, that's okay. See, it's not an atrocity if our side does it. So this is what we've come to. The Russians finally got rid of the Kiev regime in Bakhmut, which is a town in Donbass, which Donbass have voted to become free of Ukraine, to secede from Ukraine last year, just like the American colonies voted to secede from the British crown. But, you know, we don't hear about that anymore. We don't believe in the right of the people to decide their own destiny anymore. Well, depends on the people. Now, if it's Taiwan, yeah. Absolutely have the right to choose for themselves if they want to be under that particular crown or not. But if it's someone that the United States supports the regime of, well, then no matter what, you cannot leave. So anyhow, the Russians raised the flag over Bakhmut on Saturday, which was the day they officially announced that they had rooted out all those little Nazis that were still there, you know, blowing up buildings and stuff, fighting to the end. I don't understand. Well, yeah, I think it's mostly the nationalists that fought so bitterly. I think most of the conscripts, what they say, their life expectancy was like 4 hours. What they did was they threw them in the front to save the Nazis and the nationalists. Yeah, they killed a lot of people there. It was just really horrific. They should have left a long time ago, but the United States wouldn't let them. Well, the Pentagon said, you know what, give up. You're not going to win. But the State Department, you know, Victoria Cookies Nuland and Sullivan, Blinken, yeah, they don't care. They don't care about Ukrainian lives. Well, as a matter of fact, they want Ukrainians gone so that BlackRock can move into Ukraine more easily. Anyhow, as soon as the Russians defeated the Kiev regime in Bakhmut on Saturday, why, 2 days later, there's a terrorist attack in Russia, pre-war Russia. I guess you could call it proper Russia or Russia before. Into Russian territory. What they did was, because this is how terrorists do, first they attacked the border guards, who were basically just there to check papers and stuff as you cross the border. And then they went in and they started attacking. Oh, they blew up a house and they blew up a car and they wounded 7 citizens. And, you know, they did the usual thing that terrorists do. And then the United States media, mighty wolves of propaganda, of course, represented as a great and glorious uprising against the evil Putin regime. And then they told us that the citizens, the same ones that they were bombing, right, were coming out and waving flags and support and saying, thank you for liberating us. No, they didn't. God, it's like the propaganda is so unbelievable. I just can't believe. I mean, how many years do you have to be lied to before you look at some news story they're telling you and you go, well, that don't sound right. As my friend Tracy once said about the Osama bin Laden story, well, that don't sound right. Anyhow, I digress. So that's what they do when they talk about setting up insurgencies. What they mean is it's too hard to fight soldiers because soldiers have guns and can't fight back. So it's way easier to fight civilians because they're mostly unarmed, you know, and even if they do what they have a shotgun or something, they aren't going to be able to fight terrorists. So that's who they're going for. That's who they went for. Basically, I think what they did it for was not just because they were throwing a little snip fit. We lost fighting soldiers. We're going to go kill civilians. But also just to get the news media something to talk about besides the downfall of Mahmoud, because they've been telling Americans for months now that it was very, very important that they keep Mahmoud, even though the town is insignificant. Oh, yeah, there's absolutely no significance to the town. But we're going to keep it anyway because it's not important. It's totally insignificant. All right, whatever. They lost it. So then they were trying to get the media attention onto something else because they'd been saying they were going to keep it no matter what for months. And then all of a sudden they're like, oops. Well, of course they did the thing. Well, sure, it's only a flesh wound, sir. Yes, we've lost the center of town, but we're over here on the suburbs, the flanks. We're still fighting on the flanks. But whatever, then they decided to go do terrorism in Russia. So I thought today I would talk about the history of U.S. support for insurrections and for destabilization of countries the United States doesn't like, using insurgents and terrorists. So I know a couple weeks ago I talked about how the United States supported and armed the Ukrainian Nationalist Force, the OUN, UCN, that had fought with Hitler during the war. Well, this was only in the Western Ukraine. Of course, Eastern Ukraine was all against the Nazis, obviously. But Western Ukraine kind of went, oh, our friends, the Nazis, here, we will help you. We will kill the Poles. We will kill the Jews. We will kill any Ukrainians who are anti-Nazi. We're going to kill Russians. We're going to kill all of our enemies, and then we can be best buddies. And the Nazis are like, sure, dudes, okay, you're Slavs. You aren't our kind of people. You aren't the master race, but we'll let you go ahead and do your mass murders, and then later on we'll take care of you. But after the war, the United States took on the project because, again, the Germans lost, but the Nazis didn't. And they supported, armed, and trained the nationalists that were still fighting for 10 years. It took the Soviets 10 years to stop them, and they killed 35,000 citizens in between 1945 and 1955. Because that's how they do. And that's not the only place that the United States supported the people who had fought on the wrong side of the war. For instance, and the people that had fought on the right side of the war, they persecuted them. Like in Italy. It's like the horror movies where the woman's kidnapped by the evil guy, the bad guy, and then the sheriff comes and she's all happy because she's like, yay, I'm rescued. But then it turns out that the sheriff's in cahoots with the bad guy. Yeah, that's how it was. The partisans in Greece, the partisans in France, the partisans in Italy, they all pretty much got persecuted after the war. And then what happened in Germany was, once the Soviets beat the Germans at the Battle of Stalingrad, they started pushing them back out of Russia. They were pushing them back toward Germany, and the United States realized, oh heck, if we don't get up there and stop them, they could liberate the entire Western Europe. So they invaded Western Europe in June 6, 1944, D-Day, and they started marching toward Germany, and the Soviets and the Americans both got to Germany about the same time, and they divided Germany in half, and that included Berlin. Well, actually, Berlin they divided in four parts. It was the Soviets, the Americans, the Brits, and the French. Well, the Brits and the French, they left their areas first. They're like, here, you can have it, America. And then the Soviets left after that. They just handed it over to the East Germans. But the Americans, they're still there. How about that? 74 years later, we're still there, you know, liberating Germany. Mm-hmm, sure. Okay, so whatever. So then I thought I would go ahead and talk about, for a while there, they did not have a wall between East Berlin and West Berlin. And then they put one up. Then in 1989, they tore it down and everyone celebrated and Pink Floyd did a concert there and everyone was like, yay, freedom! And it was really sold as a, you know, Ronald Reagan, that senile old fool we had for a president before this senile old fool. Why does America like senile old fools to lead their country? I don't get it. Anyhow, so William Blum wrote this 10/20/2014. It's called The Two Sides of the Berlin Wall. And he says, November 9th will mark the 25th anniversary of the tearing down of the Berlin Wall. The extravagant hoopla began months ago in Berlin. In the United States, we can expect all the Cold War cliches about the free world versus communist tyranny to be trotted out, and the simple tale of how the wall came to be will be repeated. In 1961, the East Berlin communists built a wall to keep their oppressed citizens from escaping to West Berlin and freedom. Why? Because commies don't like people to be free to learn the truth. What other reason could there have been? First of all, before the wall went up in 1961, thousands of East Germans had been commuting to the West for jobs each day and then returning to the East in the evening. Many others went back and forth for shopping or other reasons. They were clearly not being held in the East against their will. Why then was the wall built? Now remember, 1961, that is, what is it? 16 years after the war has ended. But we were told that the evil East Germans hated freedom. Well, how come they didn't hate freedom for the first 16 years? Anyhow, two major reasons. One, the West was bedeviling the East with a vigorous campaign of recruiting East German professionals and skilled workers who had been educated at the expense of the communist government. This eventually led to a serious labor and production crisis in the East. As one indication of this, the New York Times reported in 1963, West Berlin suffered economically from the wall by the loss of about 60,000 skilled workmen who had commuted daily from their homes in East Berlin to their places of work in West Berlin. It should be noted that in 1999, USA Today reported, when the Berlin Wall crumbled, 1989, East Germans imagined a life for freedom where consumer goods were abundant and hardships would fade. 10 years later, a remarkable 51% say they were happier with communism, unquote. Earlier polls would likely have shown that even more than 51% expressing such a sentiment. For in the 10 years, many of those who remembered life in East Germany with some fondness has passed away. Although even 10 years later, in 2009, the Washington Post could report, quote, Westerners in Berlin say they are fed up with the tendency of their Eastern counterparts to wax nostalgic about communist times, unquote. It was in the post-unification period that a new Russian and Eastern Europe proverb was born. Everything the communists said about communism was a lie, but everything they said about capitalism turned out to be the truth. It should be further noted that the division of Germany into two states in 1949, setting the stage for 40 years of Cold War hostility, was an American decision, not a Soviet one. Two, during the 1950s, American Cold Warriors in West Germany instituted a crude campaign of sabotage and subversion against East Germany designed to throw that country's economic and administrative machinery out of gear. Okay, this is how they do it. Pay attention, because they do it in Cuba. They do it all over the world, and they're going to do it in Ukraine, no doubt. CIA and other U.S. intelligence and military services recruited, equipped, trained, and financed German activist groups and individuals of West and East to carry out actions which ran the spectrum from juvenile delinquency to terrorism, anything to make life difficult for the East German people and weaken their support of the government, anything to make the commies look bad. It was a remarkable undertaking. The United States and its agents used explosives, arson, short-circuiting, and other methods to damage power stations, shipyards, canals, docks, public buildings, gas stations, public transportation, bridges, etc. They derailed freight trains. Oh, by the way, they've been derailing freight trains in Russia also in the last month. Derailed freight trains, seriously injuring workers, burned 12 cars of a freight train and destroyed air pressure hoses of others, used acid to damage vital factory machinery, put sand in the turbine of a factory, bringing it to a standstill, set fire to a tire-producing factory, promoted work slowdowns in factories, killed 7,000 cows of a cooperative dairy through poisoning. Yeah, killing cows, that sounds familiar. It's almost as if the chickens come home to roost, right? Added soap to powdered milk destined for East German schools. Okay, do you see what I'm saying? They're going after children there. They're like, oh, this is powdered milk for kids? Let's put soap in it. Were in possession when arrested of a large quantity of the poison quinthiidine, with which it was planned to produce poison cigarettes to kill leading East Germans, set off stink bombs to disrupt political meetings, attempted to disrupt the World Youth Festival in East Berlin by sending out forged invitations, false promises of free bed and board, false notices of cancellations, etc., carried out attacks on participants with explosives, firebombs, and tire puncturing equipment, forged and distributed large quantities of food ration cards to cause confusion, shortages, and resentment, sent out forged tax notices and other government directives and documents to foster disorganization and inefficiency within industries and unions. All this and much more. The Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars of Washington, D.C., conservative Cold Warriors, and one of their Cold War and International History Project working papers states, quote, "The open border in Berlin exposed the GDR, which is East Germany, to massive espionage and subversion, and as the two documents in the appendixes show, its closure gave the communist state greater security," unquote. Throughout the 1950s, the East Germans and the Soviet Union repeatedly lodged complaints with the Soviets' erstwhile allies in the West and with the United Nations about specific sabotage and espionage activities, and called for the closure of the offices in East Germany they claimed were responsible and for which they provided names and addresses. Their complaints fell on deaf ears. Inevitably, the East Germans began to tighten up entry into the country from the West, leading eventually to the infamous wall. Let's also not forget that while East Germany completely denazified in West Germany for more than a decade after the war, sounds familiar, right? The highest government positions in the executive, legislative, and judicial branches contained numerous former Nazis. Well, it was actually longer than that, because I remember that. What was that guy's name? Kurt Waldheim? Or maybe he was NATO. I don't know. Anyhow, yeah, the Nazis were around for longer than 10 years. Finally, it must be remembered that Eastern Europe became communist because Hitler, with the approval of the West, used it as a highway to reach the Soviet Union to wipe out Bolshevism forever, and that the Russians in World War I and II lost about 40 million people because the West had used this highway to invade Russia. It should not be surprising that after World War II, the Soviet Union was determined to close down the highway. And that explains why Russia has been complaining since 1991 that although the United States, the Americans, told them, "We will not expand NATO one inch to the east," they lied. Because you know what? The Nazis weren't defeated. They just moved countries. They lied. And ever since 1991, NATO has been marching toward the east, the same as the Nazis before them and the Germans before that and Napoleon before that. So, yeah, you wonder why Russia is so determined to have a buffer zone? Because they need a buffer zone. That's why. And putting nukes in Ukraine was the last straw. They didn't actually do it. The Russians put a stop to that. So now I'm going to give you some words from John Stockwell. This was a speech he gave in 1987 at the height of the U.S. attacks on the people in Central America. He also talks about Angola, which people forget, but yeah, that also happened. John Stockwell is the highest ranking CIA official. Oh, this is called The Secret Wars of the CIA, and it's from libcon.org. He ran a CIA intelligence gathering post in Vietnam, was the task force commander of the CIA's secret war in 1975 and 1976, and was awarded the Medal of Merit before he resigned. Stockwell's books, In Search of Enemies, published by W.W. Norton in 1978, is an international bestseller. Well, remember, this is in 1987. This guy was still allowed to give speeches. This guy wrote a book, and a publisher actually published it. He was internationally known. You think that could happen nowadays? No, it could not. They have taken control. I did 13 years in the CIA altogether. I sat on a subcommittee of the NSC, so I was like a chief of staff, making the important decisions, and my job was to put it all together and make it happen and run it, an interesting place from which to watch a covert action being done. I testified for days before the Congress. You think Congress would investigate this kind of thing today? No, they wouldn't. They were asking if we had to do with South Africa that was fighting in the country. In fact, we were coordinating this operation so closely that our airplanes, full of arms from the States, would meet their airplanes in Kinshasa, and they would take our arms in Dongola to distribute our forces for us. What I found with all this study is that the subject, the problem, if you will, for the world, for the U.S., is much, much, much graver, astronomically graver, than just Angola and Vietnam. I found that the Senate Church Committee has reported in their study of covert actions that the CIA ran several thousand covert actions since 1961, and that the heyday of covert action was before 1961, that we have run several hundred covert actions a year, and the CIA has been in business for a total of 37 years. Again, can you imagine Congress looking into the CIA today? Not if they want to stay alive. Remember Chuck Schumer, who told Rachel Maddow, I think it was, that Trump, he'd better watch out, talking about the deep state, because they had six ways to Sunday to get back at you if you cross them. Yeah, they learned when the CIA blew off John F. Kennedy's head in 1963 after John F. Kennedy threatened to abolish the CIA, and then they put Alan Dulles in charge of the investigation. Do you think the rest of the U.S. government, including the Congress and every president since then, didn't learn from that? Yeah, they learned. What we're going to talk about tonight is the United States National Security Syndrome. Now, remember, this was in 1987. That's why he's saying the CIA has been around for 37 years. It's been around for a lot longer now, and it's embedded in every agency in the government. And as Rich and I have talked about so many times, it's embedded in the media and the social media. What we're going to talk about tonight is the U.S. National Security Syndrome. We're going to talk about how and why the U.S. manipulates the press. We're going to talk about how and why the U.S. is pouring money into El Salvador and preparing to invade Nicaragua, how all of this concerns us directly. I'm going to try to explain to you the other side of terrorism. That is, the other side of what the Secretary of State Schultz talks about. In doing this, we'll talk about the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the Central American War. Everything I'm going to talk to you about is represented one way or the other already in the public records. You can dig it all out for yourself without coming to hear me if you so choose. See, that's not true anymore either. They classify everything. They classify things that are in no way should be classified. But back then, it was public record. Newspaper didn't publish it. But if you would go to the Library of Congress or National Archives, you could dig it out. That's what I.F. Stone did. He just went down there to the National Archives and read it for himself instead of listening to the press secretaries spout their bull. And then he says, books based on information gotten out of the CIA under the Freedom of Information Act, testimony before the Congress, hearings before the Senate Church Committee, research by scholars, witnesses of people throughout the world who have been to these target areas that I'm talking about. So yeah, there you go. They did cover up a lot of it, but then they passed the Freedom of Information Act, which is a kind of also been hamstrung now. They got that thing all tied up. Testimony for the Congress. Congress now wouldn't think of investigating anything important. Research by scholars. You think any scholar nowadays would jeopardize their job by researching CIA terrorism? Witnesses of people throughout the world who have been to these target areas? Yeah. There was a nun from Syria who, when the United States first started attacking Syria, came to the United States to talk about the terrorism that the Al-Qaeda and ISIS groups that the United States was backing had done to the people of Syria. And she was talking about the kids that were kidnapped from a little town in northern Syria. And then when the Syrian government asked the OSCW to come and investigate the use of chemical weapons by the terrorists. Well, what happened was the night they arrived, 2 hours after they arrived, there was a sarin gas attack just like 2 miles away or something like that from where the investigators were. And we were told through the mighty Wurlitzer, and there's a bunch of clueless people who cannot seem to understand that if you've been lied to 99 times, this 100th time they're not telling you the truth. Anyhow, for some reason, what we were told, because the media, of course, is just a puppet, that the Syrians gassed their own people and there was a bunch of kids that were killed, right? Well, what happened was when the parents of the children who had been kidnapped from the village saw the pictures, they're like, oh my God, that's our kids. You know, the kids had been missing for like 2 weeks. A bunch of terrorists roll into town in their Toyota trucks provided to them by the United States of America, kidnap the kids, take them off. The parents have no idea where they went, where their kids were, no idea what happened to their kids until they see this so-called gas attack that supposedly the Syrian government invites the OPCW to Syria to investigate the terrorists using sarin. And right when the investigators arrive, they choose to use poison gas on their own people, including children. And this is the story that people were told. This is probably the story that you would still hear if they ever talked about it again. It's so mind-boggling stupid that no one could possibly have believed it, and a lot of people didn't. But there was still enough people that believed it, and then that's when Obama wanted to use that as excuse to bomb Syria. Anyhow, the nun came, and she was telling the story. Those kids were kidnapped kids. Those kids were poisoned by the terrorists. Their parents recognized them. They're like, that's my baby. So she was coming to America to give testimony the way they used to do Witness for Peace back in the 80s, where you could go from church. People would go down to Nicaragua or Salvador and witness themselves, witness the atrocities, and then come back and go from place to place. People cared back then more. I mean, then there was more people going out and listening to lectures and stuff. You don't see that anymore. And so there was that kind of thing going on. But when this Syrian nun came to try and tell the people of America the truth about Syria, the Americans revoked her passport, said, you cannot, no, you're out of here. And the Syrian ambassador, who was supposed to have freedom of movement in the host country, they wouldn't let him go more than 20 miles outside of Washington, D.C. I mean, it's an absolute atrocity. Actually, I probably don't want to talk too much about what they do to these people. I mean, I know I say a lot of gross things and horrible atrocities, and I tell you about them all the time, but he really gets into the nitty-gritty there. What's happening in Nicaragua Day is covert action. It's a classic destabilization program, what they're planning for Ukraine now. In November 16, 1981, President Reagan allocated $19 million to form an army, a force of Contras, they're called, Eximos and National Guards, the monsters who were doing the torture and terror in Nicaragua that made the Nicaraguan people rise up and throw out the dictator and throw out the guard. We went back to create an army, these people. We are killing and terrorizing people. Not only in Nicaragua, but the Congress has leaked to the press, reported in the New York Times, they wouldn't do that today, that there are 50 covert actions going around the world today. You have to be asking yourself, why are we destabilizing 50 corners of the troubled world? When the U.S. doesn't like a government, they send the CIA in. Well, now they send the NED. That was the big reform of the 70s and 80s. They privatized it. They outsourced it. They turned it over to the NED and other NGO groups like Open Society. And then they said, no, the CIA has nothing to do with this. So people of the 80s, the 70s and 80s, Americans back then, actually were horrified and they cared about it and they tried to put a stop to it, but it didn't work. When the U.S. doesn't like a government, they send the CIA in with its resources and activists, hiring people, hiring agents to tear apart the social and economic fabric of the country as a technique for putting pressure on the government, hoping that they can make the government come to the U.S.'s terms, or the government will collapse altogether and they can engineer a coup d'etat and have the thing wind up with their own choice of people in power. Now, ripping apart the economic and social fabric, of course, is fairly textbookish. What we're talking about is going in and deliberately creating conditions where the farmer can't get his produce to market, or in Syria, just stealing the wheat, where children can't go to school, where women are terrified inside their homes as well as outside their homes, where government administration and programs grind to a complete halt, where the hospitals are treating wounded people instead of sick people, where international capital is scared away and the country goes bankrupt. If you ask the State Department today what is their official explanation of the purpose of the Contras, they say it's to attack economic targets, meaning break up the economy of the country. Of course, they're attacking a lot more. And remember, the first thing the United States did when Russia invaded last year, they're like, oh boy, we're going to put sanctions on. We're going to make them scream. We're going to make the people suffer. We're going to make the economy go to tatas, to quote Ursula von Crazy. To destabilize Nicaragua beginning in 1981, we began funding this force of Somoza's ex-National guardsmen, calling them the Contras. We created this force. It did not exist until we allocated money. We've armed them, put uniforms on their backs, boots on their feet, give them camps in Honduras to live in, medical supplies, doctors, training, leadership directions, and we sent them in to destabilize Nicaragua. Under our direction, they have systematically been blowing up granaries, sawmills, bridges, government offices, schools, health centers. They ambush trucks so the produce can't get to market. They raid farms and villages. That farmer has to carry a gun while he tries to plow, if he can plow at all. Systematically, the Contras have been assassinating religious workers, teachers, health workers, elected officials, government administrators. Remember the assassination manual that surfaced in 1984? It caused such a stir that Reagan had to address it himself in the presidential debates with Mondale. They use terror. This is a technique they're using to traumatize the society so it can't function. Anyhow, there's more. It's called The Secret Wars of the CIA by John Stockwell. I would recommend looking it up, printing it out, and then checking it off as they teach the Ukrainian terrorists to attack Russia. I bet it's going to sound pretty familiar to you. All right, that's the end of Occupy the Air. We'll see you next week.